gambling machine data telling about betting, I think I talked about that. Case study of harm minimization. But anyway, the speaker is Karthik Tadinada, and he also is from Future Space. And the Future Space website mentions that they study adaptive behavior analytics, which we're now going to be exposed to, I think. Quite what that's going to do to us is, remains to be seen. So, over to you.
All right, thanks, Ted. I think, so Dave sends his apologies. So apparently this talk was booked in ages ago, 6 or 7 months ago, and he unfortunately has had to be away in the US on company business, so he asked me to deputize for him. I run the data science group, so building the model building group at Future Space, and even though I wasn't involved in all of the work that's being presented here, I was involved in some of it. So hopefully that gives me a small qualification to speak about this. So I think, you know, one of the things that was interesting for me is when I heard I was talking to a statistical group, I'm very aware that, you know, what we do at Future Space is, you know, very much more along the machine learning side of things, where you collect some data, you extract some signals, you learn a function that makes a good predictor, and then you move on, right? But there are lots of really subtle statistical questions that come up in production that might not be the ones that you're thinking about. So, like, you know, so for a while I was a teacher. One of the things that I used to teach the kids was, you know, confidence intervals around means and, like, you know, variances and hypothesis testing and things like that. But in the age where your sample is the population, you're no longer sampling, you can actually work with the entire data set. The statistical questions you need to think about and work on are slightly more subtle and, like, much, much deeper. So hopefully I'll give you a flavor of how that works through this case study that we did for the Responsible Gambling Trust. So here's some context, right? So what we're talking about here are these fixed odds betting terminals. And when I was a student, I did a project at school looking at, like, you know, strategies for blackjack and, like, various other things. And our conclusion, I still remember, was that the statistically wise do not gamble. And so I thought that actually, I'm pretty certain not many of you have seen what a fixed odds betting terminal looks like. So here's a video of what it looks like. So that's the screen, and this is... this is the 100-to-1 roulette. And so what you're betting on appears up here.
What is the function of repeated key pressing?
So you're betting on, so you see it says you're betting on a straight, you're betting on 11, 12 splits, or things like that. So, and each key press...
He's going around doing this all over the place very quickly.
So I think this is mainly for demonstration purposes. Oh. And so you select whatever...
Lots of different bets he's putting on.
Yeah. By the way, that person... Bets. Yeah. Repeated bets on the same number, but that person just bet £40. Right, so that's the one thing that you probably may not have noticed. Each time he touches the screen, it's a 25p bet, and you can just go crazy on that. So that was that just there was a £40 bet, and he won £50. By the way, so. And, you know, so you see the total stake was £40, total winnings was £25, and, you know, so Of course, if you are playing with wins, you bet even more aggressively because it's free money, and let's see what happens. And you notice the total stake just whacking right up. It's incredibly easy to do. And here you go. And it stops. And your money's gone. That's what the gameplay looks like, and that's what those machines look like in a betting shop. Legally, they're limited to, I think, a maximum of 2 machines per shop, so there are various limits. So again, 33.2 million, the amount staked on dangerously addictive betting machines, Justin Bolton. So this is from The Guardian, I think, that has a direct line into an anti-FOBT, fixed odds betting terminal, they call them FOBTs. Well, I'm not going to read that out, but...
Well, it just means that they just keep spinning a coin, doesn't it?
Yes, right. But the thing that's really interesting is it makes it possible to stake large amounts pretty quickly, right? So you can bet up to £100 each spin. So I think, they've been described as the crack cocaine of gambling. So they've been described as highly addictive. And I guess the gambling industry wanted some way to say, okay, well, clearly it provides entertainment for a substantial proportion of their customers, but there are also a proportion of their customers that are suffering harm. So the question that we got asked was, is it possible to distinguish between harmful and non-harmful gaming machine play? And it was project funded by the Responsible Gambling Trust, involved the Gambling Commission, NATSEM, and the Department for DCMS, I think. So what happened was actually pretty unprecedented. The entire industry, anyone who operates gaming machines, decided to pull their data together and give it out to tender to say, okay, well, look at this data and tell us whether it's possible to spot, problem gamblers or not. So Scientific Games and Inspired Games are the only two manufacturers of gaming machines that are in the UK. And we got data from every single machine in every high street shop in the country. So I'll come back to those limitations later. So this is what the gaming machine data looks like, right? So it was actually quite narrow. There's very, very few columns, but it was quite big. So this was effectively a log of what happened at every single gaming machine across the country for a period of 10 months. Okay, so usually... so. And what's interesting here is that most companies have these loyalty cards, right? So if you had a loyalty card, you had the player ID from their loyalty card. But most of the time, you didn't. It was only about, I would say, less than a quarter of the cases, you would have that loyalty card information. So 3/4 of the data was just purely unlabeled. Okay, and you had things like at this time and this day, so I've left the day out, what happened, what the balance was on the machine, what the action was, and what game they were playing. So, for example, what you can see here, so this stretch is a stretch of play similar to what you saw on the screen, right? So someone played something, lost £11.60 on roulette, then won £7.20 also on roulette, and carries on until their balance is zero, and then you see a gap. So we don't actually get, like, you know, start of session, end of session. We just get activity logs like this. And then sometimes we're lucky and we get player cards, and so we can follow individual players and see what's happening. Okay, so
I'm not quite sure what's meant here by balance.
Ah, so that's the amount that was... Okay, so...
Because
so here we go. So if we say, if I'm putting cash in, so if you put in £10, the amount of money that you have that is available to stake is also £10. If you put in... So if you put in another £10, now your balance is now 20. You put in another £10, your balance is 30. So you have £30 available to stake because you put in £10 three times.
Yeah.
And then basically this person decided for some reason that they didn't want to play, and so they cashed out.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the balance is now minus 30.
No, the balance is here. The balance
is
this column. Yeah, so the value of the transaction is here. So this is either what you won or lost, or what you took out.
Sorry about that, yeah.
That's okay? Sure. Yes. Yeah, so this is for a single machine. So this is like you have a machine.
You've got the date
yeah, exactly. So we have a machine ID, a date, and so those are the things that we... So there's a couple of columns that we haven't... And of course, there's a table of metadata that says this machine was located in this shop with this postal ID and things like that. But yes, everything had a machine ID with it. So how much data did we use? There was actually 6 billion bets between September 2013 and June 2014. And those are just the stakes placed. And actually, if we counted every single interaction, so the cashes in, the cash in and cash out, we had over 10 billion of them, right? So going back to what I was saying earlier, this is not like one of those things where you take a sample. This is every single piece of data that happened, right? So just because you have a lot of data doesn't mean your statistical problems go away, right? So usually, I used to teach my kids that, you know, whenever there's a question on an A-level statistical exam about, you know, discriminating between hypotheses and things like that, like the answer is always collecting more data. Here, that's most certainly not the case. There is no more data to collect. So now if I go back, so just to give you an idea of like what the data we collected, if I go back and say, okay, well, what the limitations of this study were. So problem gambling is, multifaceted problem, right? So the gaming industry in the UK is probably one of the most advanced in the world. They offer you the ability to stake on pretty much anything. They offer the ability to play online. They offer the ability to play via mobile app. This study was entirely focused just on the fixed odds betting tournaments. So that's the thing, that's the last point there. The players surveyed play multiple gaming products. So they play the lottery, they play, you know, pretty much anything you can name, they gamble on. The other thing as well, like, so particularly when you're doing machine learning or when you're doing any kind of statistics, I guess, that the key thing is to say, okay, well, what am I looking for, right? I mean, you say spot problem gamblers. Well, who are problem gamblers? And so the definition is very woolly of a problem gambler. And I think the most accepted definition comes out of a survey that you can administer that came out of some research from the Canadian Gambling Commission. I think it was in 2001, and I have all of the questions and how all of that works. So the other thing as well is because we didn't have labels for who was interacting with the machine when, the best we could do was to use as our analysis of a visit, a session. But I think at this point already, I don't think they were intervening yet, but towards the end of our data sample, the operators were intervening to stop people playing for more than half an hour at a time, or stop people playing if they had spent or lost more than £250 at the time. So that becomes quite tricky, because what you would then do is you'd have people come, play for a little while, and then go away for a couple of minutes, or go on some other machine and play. So if their play was limited on one machine, they would stop on that machine and move to the next one. Right. So this thing was a big thing, right? So defining what a player was, and not having, the ability to tie a session back to an individual was quite limited. The other thing as well that's really funny is that gamblers are very superstitious and very strange people. So very often, even if they did have a card, they wouldn't use it, because they would say something like, if I put my card in, then the company knows exactly how much money I have to lose, and they'll make me lose more. So it was a very strange dynamic. So they would put their card in when, they'd first started and had a couple of bets, but after a big win, they would withdraw all of the money, but continue to play without the card on an adjacent machine. So it was all, quite interesting. I've walked through the data. So given that was the data that we had, we needed to come up with some way of sessionizing this data, right? And saying, how do I decide when a session stops and when a session carries on? There are some obvious things to do, right? So you kind of look for, so obviously that's the end of one session and the start of a new one. But, for example, here, that is quite likely to be a new session too. Right, but that's only separated by 4 minutes, that's separated by 3 hours. So there are some things that are obvious and you can get for free, and there are some things that you need to work quite hard to get. And so in the standard machine learning way, what we did was we looked at all of the tagged sessions, because we knew when they ended with a cash out, and we trained a model to predict the end of a session, right? So because we knew when a session ended. So in particular, cash outs were indicative, long gaps in activity were indicative. And we then applied that to the entire unlabeled data set, right? Just to say, what was the gaps between things. So of course, it helps really that we were looking at things from a machine's perspective. From the machine's perspective, is it a different player standing in front of me than there was, a couple of minutes ago or something like that, right? So whether they have the card in or not, that helped us a little bit. And so when we're talking about this proxy session score, so those are the scores that came from that model that we used to predict when a session ended, or when a session started. And so once we did that, and we said, if there's a big enough change in that session score, then we say that that's a new one, and then we sessionize it. So that is session one, that was session two, and because there is a player ID that was, we can tag it with that, and that's a new session, that's session three. So it took us, obviously you kind of think, if you had every piece of data, that creates problems of its own, right? Dealing with 6 billion data points, you can't put that in Excel, right? You do have to think a little bit about what you do with it. Then you also have, collecting large volumes of data is very, very easy. I think, I've heard you, James, say about, collecting data on the internet, collecting all of this kind of stuff. But I think in that, what's happened is that the data is not collected carefully. It's not well labeled, it's noisy, it's missing rows. But the saving grace is there's plenty of it. If you throw 10% away, it doesn't matter. It's a really interesting thing, working with curators. We work with financial data and all of that other stuff, transaction data as well. And that stuff is very well curated, very well looked after, all of that kind of stuff. So working with this kind of data where, you know, you don't necessarily know when sessions start and end, we're kind of, you know, bending this data to suit purposes that it was never intended for. This was intended as an audit log to check the machines are operating correctly. And we're kind of trying to make it, you know, say something else about gambling behavior. So that was a big challenge. And so once you have data, then obviously if you're trying to create a model, you need targets, you need labels, you need to say, well, what am I trying to predict? And so remember I said that the definition of problem gambling was someone who either suffers mental or financial harm from their gambling habit, right? And so this problem gambling severity index, like I said before, was came out of a Canadian research study, and there are a bunch of questions that you ask, and the person being asked has only four choices. They can say either never, sometimes, most of the time, or almost always. So when you think of the past 12 months, have you bet more than you could really afford to lose? When you gambled, did you go back another day to try and win back the money you lost? Has gambling caused you any health problems? Like, you know, there's a whole bunch of questions, and I'm not going to read them all out, but you present this instrument and you add up all of the points. And this came from a study that they did, that the Canadian Gambling Commission did, and then they said that, okay, well, you know, here, one or two low levels of problems, eight or more problem gambling with negative consequences and possible loss of control. So when we were asked to predict problem gambling, we said that people with a score, I think, of six or more were labeled as problem gamblers. Okay, so that's what we were trying to predict.
That score, if you go back to the list of questions, say a score of six could be obtained by six ones and three zeros.
Correct.
And so it would be six times sometimes.
Correct.
Which is labeled as a problem.
Yeah, but correct, right? But the thing is, if you say six times something, you will be saying yes to some of these things, right? Have you borrowed money or sold anything to get money to gamble? Has gambling caused you health problems? Have people criticized your betting or told you that you had a gambling problem? So there's nine questions, right? So if you're answering sometimes to six of them, you're saying things like, you're saying at least one of these things, right? Gambling caused financial problems for your household. Guilty when you gamble. So I think, so the key thing for me is that this is actually a reasonably well-designed instrument. There is no way to get a score of six or above without admitting that you've either caused yourself mental or financial harm.
Yeah. Isn't there a good chance that people, gamblers, lie?
Yeah.
Surveys like this.
Well, how much insight do they have?
So it's really interesting, right? So by the time it gets...
And they say someone has been gambling for a whole year.
Yeah.
And gambles, say, even just once a week.
Yeah.
And once has one of these reactions. So he could answer sometimes. Because he cannot answer never.
Goes back to the question. This goes back to your point, right? So I think people tend to remember the highs. So if they said, look, once 6 months ago I felt that way, usually the answer is never, right? So people, unless it's happened in the recent past, people don't say sometimes.
Surely, problem gamblers. I mean, it's a lot of self-delusion in this, isn't there?
It's fascinating.
People don't admit it to themselves, even.
Yeah,
correct.
You see, I mean, often these people are living in a bit of a fantasy world.
Correct. Right. So
the house is repossessed.
Yeah, you would think that, right? But actually, one of the things that we found that was really surprising is people were surprisingly open about this, right? So, And it's really funny. So so one of the taxi drivers who kind of drives for Panther, one of the local companies, I mean, he freely admits that he has a problem with gambling, but he says, you know what, there's nothing I can do about it. I love the excitement. So I think what's really interesting is that there is this awareness that they're chasing the thrill of winning. But I think people, I mean, it's a bit like smoking, right? People know smoking is bad for them, but they still continue to do it. I think what we find as well is that, sure, is there a proportion of people that refuse to admit what's going on? Probably. But actually, I think by far the larger proportion is people who know that, you know, sometimes their gambling crosses a line, or often, or most of the time it crosses a line, but they feel unable to do anything about it.
So it becomes an issue of control instead.
Yeah. Right, so again, like that great question, right? But I think that's what we found. So we didn't survey like a huge number of people, as someone at Ipsos would know, that's a pretty expensive thing to do. I think we surveyed, so I think Matson surveyed 4,000 people. But, you know, and it was stratified and like, well, but it was surprising. I think they did population surveys, and the estimate is that around 0.9% or just under 1% of people who gamble have a problem with gambling. And in this survey sample, so we selected the 4,000 that seemed the most extreme, and you know, it was within expected bounds of what we got. So yeah, it's interesting. I think, yeah, is there underreported? Almost certainly, but it's not anywhere near as prevalent as we originally thought.
Is that just a summary of the people who have the loyalty cards, or?
Yes, because those are the only people we could. No, right? So we couldn't do that. Yeah, certainly. Yeah. Okay. So, well, if you have that much data, then you can't look at each individual row, right? So you've got to look at, like what aggregates look like, and most of this real-world data is horrendously skewed, right? So if you kind of okay, so. And the reason this goes that long is because there was a session that long, right? Maybe that was an error in our algorithm to pick up sessions. But you get these really hugely skewed distributions where almost everything is a really short session, so that's about 10 minutes. And then above 10 minutes, there's almost no sessions at all. So it becomes very difficult to visualize what's going on. So if you do a log scale, then that becomes slightly easier, where you kind of have this big blip of people playing, like, you know, one game or maybe two, and then, you know, it kind of distributes itself. You know, here it looks like log normal, really, right? So not too bad, but it's not the case for everything. But looking at things on a log scale, you really need to get used to when you're looking at, like, you know, this stuff that comes from behavioral data. Okay, so the other thing as well that's really interesting is you can definitely tell that the data distribution is driven by people, right? So if you look at the amount deposited on a log scale, like, it's not anywhere smooth like this, which is, you know, how long they played. So this is something that people have control over, right? How much money do I deposit into the machine? And what you notice is there are spikes at that's £10, that's £20, that's £25, that's £30. So people come in and they allocate a budget to gaming. And you see spikes at even numbers. Again, like, that's very interesting, right? You wouldn't have expected this when... Yeah.
Is it a case of budget allocation, or is it a case of units of currency?
Yeah, it could be the case, but I think if you're talking about problem gamblers or something like that, you would think that they would, you know, scrabble together everything that they can, like, you know, and it would be like, you know, because, you know, let's face it, you can make any amount, right?
You can accept coins and yeah, notes and
yeah,
card. And
exactly, yeah. And so, yeah, in particular, you can so these machines accept debit cards too. Not credit cards, but they accept debit cards as well. So you know, you can theoretically put in any amount of money you want. But yeah, so there is that pattern. Okay, so we have the data, we have, so what we did was we looked at 4,000, so we had all of that data, we looked at the people who had used a loyalty card, and we looked at, you know, a sample of the 4,000 most extreme users, so like, so people who spend a lot of money or a lot of time, or both. And so the baseline that we were competing against was this, right? So someone is a problem gambler if they spend more than £250 in a session, or they spend more than 30 minutes playing, right? And so this was the baseline used by the industry.
By spend, do you mean lose?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Okay, so, well, what does that look like? Well, if you use just the monetary rule, so if you say, if you spend more than £250, what happens, right? So £250 is there. So basically, you're correctly classifying 99.3% of the non-problem gamblers, but you're only catching 1.3% of the problem gamblers. So actually, you've missed most of them. And what's really interesting is when you kind of look, so when we did some further work, when you kind of look at where this problem gambling is concentrated, it's in generally in areas of high deprivation where losing £250 is, you know, a month of spending money. So, and where people were losing, like, you know, much more than £250 was, you know, Kensington or Virginia Water or somewhere like that, where, you know, chances are they probably could afford to lose that much. And, you know, that was some money worth well spent to them. It was entertainment. So, and of course, the other thing as well, and this is the classical statistical problem of, like, you know, you have a test, it's 99% accurate, but it's a sensitivity specificity trade-off, where actually even if you misidentify 0.7% of the population, then if you look at the people that are being identified at over 250 people, your ratios are off, right? Like 0.7%. So remember, I said 99% are good, you know, good players. 1% are problem gamblers. So most of the sample that you identify using that rule are actually not problem gamblers at all, right? So, which is interesting. And again, this graph comes from survey data. So when we talk about the classification of problem versus non-problem, we've actually administered them a survey, and we said, okay, well, how many of these are problem gamblers, how many of these are not? So going back to what I said was, you know, what our approach was to this problem. So we kind of said, okay, well, let's try and identify what features might show up, right, for a problem gambler. So this is like, you know, an activity diagram. So you deposit money, you stake, you win or you lose. Like, you know, you kind of go around in this loop until you change your game. Or so they offer the option of self-excluding, i.e. saying that, oh, I recognize that I have a problem. I don't want to play anymore, right? And so if you had a loyalty card or if the shop manager recognized you, they would say, you know, look, you agreed not to play, go away.
Does churn mean?
Churn means they stop playing, right? So rather than self-excluding, churn is a term in marketing, I guess, where it means they stop being your customer. Okay, so you withdraw money and either you stop playing or you come back and deposit and you go through the cycle again. So remember at the start of the session I said, you know, people tend to play quite differently whether they're playing with winnings or whether they're playing with their own money. So this is a graph of one session where the vertical lines are money going in and the green lines are people playing with winnings and the red lines are people playing with their own money. So that axis is, you know, money won minus money spent. So i.e. that's the player profit, so that's how much profit they have. And so you can see they put some money in, lose a bit. But one of the things that really stands out here though is that the steps up are much bigger than, like, okay, some of these are quite big, but you know, the, in general, the losses are small notches, whereas the wins are quite big spikes, right? And so, and obviously this is one session, but generally you see this pattern where if you won and you're betting with money that you won, you're a lot looser and you're willing to play riskier games, bet higher amounts. And of course, I mean, obviously, if you won, there are some people that say, oh, well, you know, I want a great thing. I got to leave one on my head. And if you lose, particularly if you're a problem gambler, you have this behavior that they call chasing, where you kind of say, I've lost, but I'm going to bet a little bit more to catch up. Right, so I'm gonna. So it's like this marketing year strategy, right? You bet £2, then you bet £4, so in the hope that, you know, eventually I'll be able to leave the shop with a profit. So that's interesting, right? So that difference between staking wins and money. And so, okay, well, if I was looking for signs, if I was trying to build a model for how to spot problem gamblers, then there are multiple things I could potentially look at, right? So I could say the staking behavior and their variability. So it's, you know, again, going back to this. So am I behaving like everything is a win? So whether it's my own money or something else. And am I staking, like, you know, consistent amounts? Am I staking £2 or all the time? Or am I like just wildly everywhere, staking £100 sometimes and staking 25p at others? Payment method changes is interesting, right? So does that suggest that, you know, I've put in all the cash that I have, then I'm using a debit card, then, you know, I'm trying to do other things. So that is an interesting thing. Obviously, frequency of play and duration. So am I showing up every day? Am I playing for half an hour every day? That kind of thing. So this is the thing that I was talking about with chasing. So, oh, the other thing, other detail I forgot to mention is those machines have a limit of how quickly you can interact with them. So you can't, you know, do an action more than once every second or something like that. Or you can't stake more than once every some number of seconds. I used to know that. I don't anymore. And so what you will see sometimes if people play a lot is that their actions are on that time limit every time.
Yeah, just as a general point, what are the odds on these? When we say on roulette, pick a number, 1 to 100, I mean, and are the punters aware of the odds?
So what's fascinating is that most of these games have pretty good odds, right? So the payback ratio is something like, you know, over 90%. But I think, you know, you're still losing 10% of your money every time you bet,
yeah,
right?
Is this advertised? I mean, can you do different machines have different odds, or people can say, well, I'll play this machine because give me a better chance?
Yeah, so there are different classes of machines. So there are what's called B2 machines and B3 machines. So B2 machines are, don't quote me, one of them is a lower stake, lower payback. The other one of them is a higher stake, higher payback kind of machine. So, So for example, there are some games that take, you know, £10 bets or something like that. So they might have a higher return ratio than something that's taking 25p bets, because, you know, for it to be profitable for the gaming company, you need to be taking a larger percentage of 25p bets and a smaller percentage of like 10 or 15. So it's all highly regulated. And all of these, you know, again, part of the reason they have these audit logs is to prove that their returns are what they claim to be, and that, you know, the fluctuations are within.
Another question, were internet companies involved with this?
No. So this is purely retail, on the high street. These are high street bookmakers.
Well, that's another big issue in itself, isn't it?
Obviously. Absolutely, right. Yeah. And, I mean, so this is the other thing as well, right? So You know, this is what we laid out as a limitation early on.
Usually have in their sites, though, don't they? This is
yes. And yeah, yeah. Everyone, right? Yeah. So, and if you're,
they
so
didn't, they didn't volunteer the information from the internet.
No, right. So I think one of the things that's I think the view was that these fixed odds best betting machines, the view originally was that, well, the hypothesis was that it disproportionately affects people who might less be able to afford to spend money gambling, right? And the verdict on that, looking at the data, is very mixed, right? So you can't necessarily say problem gambling occurs everywhere. You can be really wealthy, and in a wealthy area, you can be a deprived area. Like it is, you know, it doesn't discriminate based on where you're from, right? So I think, but the other thing as well is, it was a real pain dealing with 10 billion rows of data. So I can imagine it would be an even bigger pain if, you know, someone gave us all of the data, right? So all of the betting in the retail, so like on the horses, on football, all of the internet betting.
Although that it would be easier to identify people, wouldn't it?
On the internet? On the internet, yes, but remember, still a lot of the stakes happen in high street shops, right? These things exist for a reason, right? Like, if they were not profitable, if people were not staking money on these things, you know, these are profit-making companies, they would shut these down. So if you only focus on internet gaming, that's a very small percentage of what's actually staked in the country, right? So again, going back to what I was saying earlier, you think you have everything, but you've only got a slice of the entire activity. Like, we've taken in 10 billion rows of log data. That's a lot of data. Like, I mean, you know, we had to buy new hardware to stick it on. But that's still a small fraction of all of the gaming activity. Right? It's interesting. So you can't, I mean, so this is the thing, right? You can't do, I mean, maybe you, right now, what you can't do is access all of the gambling data from all of the companies across all of the UK. Because not just that, right? I mean, so these are UK regulated companies. What about, you know, Mr. Green or any of these other companies that are based in Sweden, that are based in Malta, that are based in Gibraltar, that are free to offer their services to gamers here? I mean, like I said, it's impossible to capture everything. You do the best with the data that you have. Okay, so I think, you know, so basically, so those are the deviations of behavior, like how quickly they were staking or not staking, was another thing that we looked at. Player protection limits, so these are the limits that I was talking about earlier, like 30 minutes of play or £250 of loss. Right, so those are the limits. The thing that we didn't have any visibility into is this. And I guess, you know, people complaining that the machines were rigged or that, you know, they were irrational or aggressive towards staff, you know, that kind of thing is very difficult to capture. So we couldn't use any of that. Again, failures. So using debit cards and like saying, oh, well, you know, give me £10 from this, and actually there isn't any money there. So again, like, that's a really good method. So there are various theoretical markers of harm that you can come up with, and you can quantify them, and you can say, okay, well, you know, how would I capture this in a number that I can then stick into a model, right? So there's multiple things we tried, and the plausible markers are, you know, frequency of play, levels of play engagement, number of different games. So chasing is what I was talking about earlier, where you believe that you can, by staking a little bit more, you can make up your losses. Right? So there's that. Then again, within session, so use of autoplay, playing multiple machines. So there are people who actually stick their card in two machines in the same shop and stake on both of them. Right? So again, that's probably not a good sign. All of those things we tried. Okay, so then what happened? So again, this is a very imbalanced classification problem, right? You have 1% or less than 1% of your population that is a problem gambler, and then you have, like, you know, the vast majority that are not. So if you kind of use metrics like accuracy of my classifier, I can be 99% accurate by the simple rule of saying you are not a problem gambler, right? If no one's a problem gambler, then 99.1% of the time I'm right, and only 1% of the time I'm wrong. So metrics like accuracy and things like that don't really capture what we're trying to do. So what we do is so we call this the receiver operator characteristic. So basically, it's the trade-off between your true positives, like how many problem gamblers you correctly identify, versus your false positive rate. What percentage of the population do I need to go into to identify that proportion? So if it was just a coin flip, if you're guessing randomly, you'd be on that line. If you were good, you'd be somewhere like that, and if you were better, you'd be somewhere like that. And of course, if you were perfect, you have a rectangle that goes, or you have a square, basically, that goes like that. And usually, if you're doing a machine learning model and you end up with something like that, almost always you've made a mistake. You've left the label in for your model to learn on, and it has perfect correlation with the label, and you get something like that. So usually when you get a square, you know you've made a mistake. So that's actually pretty good. And in particular, when you're looking at human behavior, there's so much heterogeneity, there is so much diversity in what you can expect, that actually something like that is, you know, you'd be pretty happy doing. So registered play is where we have the entire history of what a person did, right? When they actually used their card to play. So we can look at the important thing here that really helps us is that we can actually build up a history of what is usual for this player. Right, so if they usually stake £20 a session, but they're suddenly staking 200, that is unusual. Right? So with non-registered play, where we don't have a card, we don't know what person is applying. So you actually have a much smaller window of data to make your decision on. Right? So registered play should be easier. Okay, so remember that's just guessing. That line is what you get if you apply that baseline method. So you're either spending over £250 a session, or you're spending more than 30 minutes in a shot. So you can see it is better than random, but it's not that much better than random. Whereas the model that we produce has, like, you know, it's, and in particular, you don't really care about the performance in this region, because you're going into 60% of the population anyway. What you really care about is the performance of the model in this region, in the low false positive rate. Because then you don't need to identify, like, you don't need to speak to 100,000 people to identify one problem gambler, right? So what you really care about is the performance in this region. So you want as high a true positive rate as possible for as low a false positive rate as possible. So here it makes a massive difference that, you know, you can identify, I don't know what that number is, but you can identify 25-30% more people with the same false positive rate. Like, that's where you really care about the performance of your model. Whether they catch up there or not, well, it's neither here nor there. Here you're saying basically everyone is a problem gambler. Here you're saying no one is a problem gambler. And then, like, you know, the better your model, the less you need to go into to identify. Yeah?
Are you doing this just to test in the same sample, or
out of sample? Yeah, it's out of sample. So you kind of, so if you had 4,000 people, you train on 3,000 and you test on 1,000, something like that. So
yeah, I mean, this is all based on the registered users, isn't
yes.
it? I mean, what evidence have you got that the registered users are typical of the non-registered users? I mean, are they different populations? And is there an incentive to register? Why do people register anyway?
But there is an incentive to register, right? So you get loyalty bonuses and, you know, all
there's
of
a financial benefit.
I would say, they get free bets or whatever it is, right? So, and in fact, we know that the population is not the same. Because if you're motivated enough to register for a card, you are a cut above your average punter that just walks in and puts £5 in, right? So we know that the populations are not the same, right? So, so it is one of those things that you say, okay, well, you know, we know that here are certain characteristics in a population that's already highly engaged with gaming, so they game a lot, and if it works for them, right, to discriminate between, so because, look, if you said that here's a population of gamers that play more than average, and here's a population that play less than average, and you say where is the likelihood of problem gambling more, you probably say that the people who play more, right? So actually, in many ways, this is the population that you care about, right? Because this is the more engaged population. So
yeah, more likely to be problem.
Correct. Yeah.
In the register rather than the not.
Exactly.
Registered.
Right. So this is the population you care about. Okay. So So increase from. So yeah, at that percentage, I think at that point there, the my arrows are not quite right. So you're basically doubling the detection at one particular false positive. Or you can decrease from 20% of your population to 6% of your population. And so again, like you're trading off on that ROC curve. You can either say, for the same true positive rate, I'm getting a lot lower false positive rate, because to get 40%, I only need to go like just under 10 rather than just over 25. Or I can say, for the same false positive rate, I can get a much higher true positive rate. And you're always making these trade-offs. It depends on what the client wants. Well, what were the things that turned out to be important? Well, things like number of playing days, so how many days in a month they go out and play. Maximum total weekly winnings, that's a strange one, but generally, because of these fixed odds, right, which is like 0.8 versus 0.9, it turns out that, you know, winnings is directly proportional to the number of stakes, right? Then average daily player loss, those are two correlated, session win, player loss, like, you know, a whole bunch of things that are related to just the amount of activity, the sheer amount of activity that people make. And then the thing that the next diverse thing that turns up is the number of different games they play in a session. So if you, for example, came in and you played, you know, a slightly more expensive game where you were staking £5 at a time, and then you ran out of money, then you still want to gamble, so you might be tempted to stake on the 25p roulette. When you get lucky, you get some money, then you can go back and stake on something else. So that is probably where that's coming from. Number of sessions per week, again, correlated with the playing days. So what happens with unregistered gamers? Well, you can see that, you know, the model here is much, much better than the model here. And this is entirely because you have no historical information to kind of aggregate, to kind of smooth out variations in something. So, if you apply that rule in unregistered play, you're pretty much guessing, right? So you're not far off guessing. Whereas, you know, if you apply, like, you know, machine learning model, you do better than chance, but nowhere near as good if you have enough history.
How do you know someone's a true positive? How do you know if someone is a positive? Because if they're not registered, you haven't got a card for them, so you haven't got a...
I think what we did here is we removed the, so we knew who they were, but we just removed the labels, right? So we just removed the players that they came from, and we predicted on a session by session basis,
right.
Rather
without
than
using
their
historical
information.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it would be hard to measure true positives without that, right? So basically, what we did was we removed that historical component. And then that gives you that, right? It is an increase, And, you know, it's a massive decrease in the number of problem gamblers identified incorrectly, but that is still not nowhere near as powerful as you can get with, like, you know, a bigger data set. So the other thing as well that I guess you've got to be careful about is to say, okay, well, you know, I'm operating at a particular point where I'm identifying a lot of problem gamblers, but you've got to be careful about the volumes that you're identifying as well, right? So if you look at the number of sessions here, right, so between 10 and 11 o'clock, you have very few sessions, but the ability for you to split problem versus non-problem is very high. So you say, oh, that's super indicative, but that doesn't actually help you at the population level because there's almost no population there, right? So, and again, like the start of the day, you see a big spike in the proportion. If you're gambling at 7 a.m., you probably have a problem, right? But again, there's very, very little of the population that, you know, games at that time.
If you're trying to control this, one thing would be to not switch machines on until 8 o'clock.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Okay, so let me skip that over. I think I'm running slightly late. So summary of results, 66% improvement in detecting problem gamblers, twice as many problem gamblers currently identified. Data from a single session of play were less successful. You know, much, much better than the random guessing that seems to be what the current industry standard did at that time. So, of course, being like a local Cambridge company, what do you do next? So what we did was we operationalized that for some of the gaming companies. So basically what we did was we said, okay, well, you know, this model that we did, we're going to put it into production for you so that you can monitor the health of your population. And if you want to send them responsible gaming messages saying, ah, look, you know, you can set your stake limit lower. You can say that I don't want to spend more than £50 a week. What does that look like? So basically that is the distribution of scores across the entire population base, right? So this is more likely to be a problem gambler. So you can see almost everyone is green. There's some people orange, and like there'll be a tiny proportion that's red. So number of deposits, again, that's a histogram of what's happening. Total losses, you know, I guess that's close to zero. And then, like, you know, you have your tails where people lose a lot and then people win a lot, right? Okay. So, but one of the things that's really interesting here, though, is that if you're taking, like, a survey, that's one thing, right? Because you have everyone's data, you survey them, and you say, at this point in time, this is what I got. But if you're kind of doing this on an ongoing basis, on an ongoing and a continuous basis, you can't actually administer surveys to customers all the time, right? You can't just say, okay, well, you know, here's. And so what we ended up doing was looking at proxies of gambling homes. So you don't actually have a PGSI score for them, but what you do have is either this person self-excluded or this person has had like several payment failures. So they've been trying to pay with a debit card. That doesn't work. Or, you know, they've tried, like, you know, 10 different debit cards in the last week and none of them have worked, that kind of thing. The other thing as well that's really interesting is that our clients place a very, very high importance on model interpretability. So if you, and it's entirely logical from their point of view, right? Because they're actually intervening with their customers. So it's a human intervention. And humans have this deep-seated need for an explanation for why something happened. So they would much, much prefer either a simple set of rules saying, ah, you spend more than £100 this week, or your spend this week has been more than 4 times the spend, like, you know, last month, or whatever it is. They very much prefer that to saying, you know, look, here's a big complex model that spat out the score, even though that complex model may be more interpretive, more accurate. So they prefer something that they can interpret and understand. So something like a logistic regression is much preferable to, you know, let's say a deep neural net or something like that. So I talked to Ted about this, about the last point. And one of the things that's really interesting is if you start off with a system that's deploying interventions to people, you have interaction data that's untainted by the interventions you suggested, right? So now you have them sent out interventions to people and you said, ah, maybe you should set a limit or maybe you should do this. And so the training data that you get next time around is biased by the fact that you then contacted these people and suggested, whether they changed their behavior, whether they changed their limits or not, certainly a message has been sent out and you don't know whether there's some kind of subconscious effect of that. So your training data is definitely biased. How much? You don't know. And that is a very, very tricky problem because you can only observe the actions that happened and you can't observe the counterfactual, right? So that is a problem that we spend increasing amounts of time thinking about of, okay, well, what do you do? I mean, obviously you have a whole bunch of this, but how do you adapt your model and how do you adapt your training data to cover the fact that, well, you know, look, you did make some interventions and things like that. So I think Ted and I were talking earlier, there's a very rich literature on bandits, multi-armed bandits, contextual bandits, all of that kind of stuff. And all of these things generally involve a little bit of randomization and kind of saying, okay, well, even though I know that this is, you know, that I would suggest this policy, let's randomize across the policy and, you know, observe the interactions in real life. So then that way you actually have an unbiased sample that's not tainted by the fact that you intervene. So again, that in itself is, you know, a talk and a half. I've taken plenty of your time, so I'll stop there. Thank you for your attention. I have time for a few questions, if there are any.
Did you say actual model involves some regression modeling? Or?
Yeah, so you can think of it that way, yeah.
So why didn't you express the results as predicted for that?
Yes, but the results that go out of clients are that. But, I mean, that's... So the number that comes out is actually irrelevant to how good a classifier something is, right? So if I multiplied all the scores by 1,000, it's just as good as at ranking the outcomes. Because what you want is you want to rank your players, right, according to the most likely to be problem gamblers are at the top, and the least likely are assigned a low score. So the scale at which they're represented doesn't really matter. It's the fact that they're ranked appropriately is what does. So I haven't actually shown what the scores are, what the outputs are from a model. But yeah, that's effectively what comes out. Did I answer your question?
Partially. So thank you. If it's a well-calibrated model and you state it in probability terms,
yeah,
then of course any sort of cutoff you take will give you the proportion of people you would expect to be actual numbers.
Correct, yes. But then, again, so that goes back to what point on that ROC curve. If it's well-calibrated, then the score is just the y-ordinate, right? So you just say, if it's not 0.9%, that, you know, if the score is not 0.9, it's 90% likely that, you know, so everyone with 90%, yes, with 90% chance, you draw that line. So that allows you to, what I'm saying is that the score, or the probability or anything, allows you to make trade-offs in exactly the same way another number would. Like what people care about is the ranking. They want to say, give me the top 500 most likely problem gamblers, and they're not hugely concerned about whether that comes as a number between 0 and 1 or a number between or as an integer between 0 and 999. Right? I mean,
yeah. Did the companies adopt this then?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so we have
they adopt it and they make the interventions,
yeah,
which is what to actually say to the client, stop.
No, so basically, so this is the tricky bit, right? Because when you make interventions, so obviously it's difficult to get sign off from your bosses to say stop, right? But what they do is they have a whole set of tools for people to manage their gambling, to say, I don't want to spend more than X amount per week or more than X amount per day. I don't want to spend more than certain amount of time per week or some time per day. or I want to take a holiday, I've lost a lot of money, please lock me out of your website for the next week, or please ban me from your website and never allow me to sign up again. So there's a whole range of tools that people have to manage their
business. The managers in the shop?
Yes. Okay, so so what has been operationalized is exactly your point, is the, so we have some for the retail, so for retail shops where it goes out to the managers and they can kind of intervene with players. The other thing as well is, you know, there are these campaigns that they run saying like when the funds stop, or they have now limits at like 30 minutes, or like they have messages saying, you know, is it time to take a break, or maybe time for a cup of tea, or something like that. So they do intervene at periods that are indicative of quite extreme behaviour.
But there's nothing to stop someone, you know, being a ghoul of the limit, basically in one shop, and then just walk to another shop and carry on.
Nothing does.
There's no link between the shops or the firms, obviously.
No.
But the companies could use their databases, use your algorithm to one of their card holders.
Yeah.
Okay. So when a card gets put in the machine, the manager could get an alert.
Yeah.
This is a potential problem.
Yeah.
There is what you might call a psychological issue, that a lot of people who, so to speak, don't objectively understand randomness can have the belief that if they lose several times in a row, it becomes more likely that they're going to win next time.
Correct.
And so the more they lose, the more they're
likely to win.
That's a self-reinforcing things, and if they believe like that, there's not much I think that can be done about it.
No, and in many ways, right, I mean, I think, like I said much earlier in this talk, right, the statistically wise do not gamble. So if you're gambling, you're probably not thinking along those lines, right? You're thinking that, you know, it seems a bit crazy.
It was suggested last week that the maximum stake would be reduced from £100 to £2 by this motion by Parliament, because it's under scrutiny at the moment by MPs, as I understand.
Yeah.
What is your opinion, having looked at data, on the effectiveness of that strategy? Do you think it would change? Would it make the baseline model work better if you did a corresponding drop in maximum loss? The equivalent would be £5, right, as a maximum loss?
Yeah, so, you know, I think, well, so, but this is the thing, right, that so we have to be really, really careful about what is being proposed, right? So they're not actually proposing limits on how much money people can spend. What they're proposing is limits on how much they can stake each time. So at the moment, it slows down the process, but does it actually change people's behavior? In some ways, I'm not convinced that it does, right? Because if you're a thrill seeker and you put in like £100, then, you know, then fine, like you get a thrill whether you win or lose. But, you know, if you're kind of getting people to play longer and longer for the same set of, like, you know, thrill of, oh, I won £100 today at the machine or something like that, then, you know, arguably it's wasting even more of their time.
But you would hit the limit. Spend less, the 30-minute limit.
Oh, correct. But remember, the 30-minute limit is, like, what happens at that point is a pop-up comes up saying time for a break, or it enforces a 30-second lockout or something like that. So there's nothing exactly, to your point, stopping you from moving over to the adjacent machine or to the adjacent shop, right? So do I believe, like, changing the stake limits will make a difference? No, right? Like, I just don't think that that's true. And also, a lot of the volume is on the 25p roulette staking, right? So you actually get a lot of the volume at that point anyway, right? So very, very few people go into a shop with, like, you know, £100 to put in and to stake straight away. So people are focused on that, like, oh yes, you know, you can lose £100 in like 15 seconds or something like that. Fine, you can, but actually that's not where most of the money is being lost.
I mean, in other areas of prediction is the issue of heterogeneity. Clearly, you have how many machines in total did you have, or how many clusters?
I think there were multiple thousands, right?
So, for example, Well, if the model was developed in Cambridge, does it apply to London?
So remember, we developed the model of data across the country. And that sense, we're very, very careful. So of these players that we had with cards, we surveyed a stratified sample of them. So for example, and we weighted, so to say, okay, well, this person in East London actually represents, like, you know, 5,000 real gamblers. And like, so each of these things was weighted in proportion to, like, you know, demography, like, you know, population and all of that kind of thing. So we were careful in that sense. Any other questions?
In response to what you said about the question on the motion, I would have thought that for, and I'm speculating, used anything, but I would have thought that if the limit was reduced really low, like you suggested, and they were forced to go to another shop, it slows down the process enough that you might thin them out. They would still do it, but they would probably lose less.
It could potentially stop until behavior as well.
Again, the aim of these 30-minute things was to insert forced pauses and thinking time into a player's activity, right? So the reason it was selected as at 30 minutes was, you know, again, like we kind of saw that, you know, it is very, very few people that play for longer than that, but when they do, they go for a really long time, right? Yeah. So I think, yeah, you're right. But again, you know, it requires very little effort to move to the adjacent machine, right, which might be free at the same time. So
it's all a question of what they want to do. Can I ask, what's the current position on betting levies and so on, fixed on?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I'm sorry.
The government does make a lot of money out of these as well, doesn't it?
Oh, I'm sure it does, right?
Yeah, I mean,
I'm sure it does.
Excise license on these machines.
I am absolutely sure that that's the case. I have no idea about the financials behind these. I know about the data that we got given and the behaviours that we saw. I don't know necessarily how these work in terms of, like, you know, fitting in the business context and the tax context.
Can I
ask
a question?
Sure.
In the factors that your model uses to predict whether somebody is a problem gambler,
uh-huh,
is it purely a question of a score that, supposing you had 100 characteristics,
yeah,
and somebody reaches a score of 50, then they're identified, or is it a more complex model?
It's a more complex model. I think, like, you know, you can certainly have, you can live in an area of high deprivation, you can live in an area of low median income, and then, you know, so those will offset then some of those other things that you're seeing, right? Like, you know, if you then change, like, how much money you need to spend before it starts to become significant into the model predictions.
And you did mention at the start, didn't you, that, you know, you could be spending quite a lot, but if you can afford to lose it, not so bad. And, you know, this is an issue of affordability, isn't it?
Correct, yeah.
I'm not sure that's sort of in this.
You know, and it's very hard to make a call on that, right? So there, like, the National Statistics Office is really good at kind of releasing demographic and income data at a pretty granular level. So you can kind of put that stuff on this. But then again, you know, particularly in London, right, you know, you have an area of high deprivation right next to a very wealthy area, and you don't know where this person came from, right? So it's very, very tricky. And unless you have card data, do you know what address that they registered, what postcode certainly that they registered to, it's very difficult to kind of make a claim on the greater than 75% of your data that you don't actually have any attribution to.
And a lot of loyalty card data is out of date anyway.
Yes.
Five years ago.
In general, isn't it true you cannot protect people from things they don't want to be protected from?
absolutely right, yeah. And that's the other thing. And I think, so this is the other thing as well that's interesting. So when we productionize something like this, it really was for the gaming companies to reach out to their clients and offer them tools and support if they were in a mood to accept it, right? And some of them are, like some proportion are, and another proportion are not. And so you're right, you know, you cannot protect them from themselves. Because
yeah, well, that was a similar thing occurred to me a bit earlier when you talked about giving what did you call it, a time for not doing it.
A timeout or break?
Yeah, a sort of forced break.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that this was considered to give them thinking time.
Yeah.
But it might just be frustration time.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got a certain set of mind which makes you want to do that sort of thing,
yeah,
then frustrating it,
yeah,
could make you even more determined to carry on doing it.
Yeah.
And you're chomping at the bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there any evidence that these machines are more addictive than other forms of gambling? We have a great irony that all the sort of public hatred of these things is of gambling and problem gambling is all directed to these machines, and yet they get the best odds, I gather, of any form of gambling.
Yeah. They do.
Thank
you.
That's a discreet target.
So, why is it that are they more addictive? Or is it just people don't like seeing betting shops in high streets and poor areas?
Probably not, right? So I think that they're very visible, right? So that's the first thing. I mean, look, again, my knowledge is limited to these particular machines, right? And to say, I haven't actually looked at cross-product gambling data to say, okay, well, you know, if I then look at the amount of money spent and things like that, do people spend more doing other things? But the thing that's really interesting is if you kind of look at, you know, some of the money that comes up, some of the amounts of money that are spent in casinos and things like that, I mean, that puts this stuff in the shape, right?
And much worse off.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so I think that this entire area is really poorly understood, right? Because I think one of the things that's really interesting is, you know, we were attacked as being like, you know, not a responsible company, not being impartial, because our funding came from the Responsible Gambling Trust. So that's an umbrella body that is funded by contributions from the gaming operators, right? So they're like, of course your thing is biased. Of course you didn't find a problem with these machines because, you know, it's in your financial interest not to do so, right? And so, you know, of course, one of the reactions I had is, I will give you 10 billion rows of data and, you know, and you find it, but of course you can't do that, right? So, we know what we did and we followed a pretty rigorous procedure, but I think to a certain extent there is this really amazing strain in people, right, where any evidence that supports your view is great and scientifically well done, but any evidence to the contrary, yeah, or something that shows ambiguity, of course, is a tainted and biased and unreliable piece of work, right? So it is a very difficult thing for us, right? And so one of these subsequent reports was published in Parliament, and there were some MPs there and activists and things like that. And, you know, particularly for activists, you know, it's a religious thing, right? Like, they believe that you are wrong and these are addictive, and that, you know, no matter what you do or what you tell them, it's like, you know, it's tainted or biased or whatever it is. And so, but you're right, it is incredible. I believe that, you know, looking at the papers, you would kind of think that these machines offer terrible odds and like all of that kind of thing, but you're right. I think it's the best payout of any form of gambling you can get. I think some of the theory is that it's the win that creates the addiction, right? So the unpredictable win that creates the addiction. So I don't really know, but there is something to be said for having like a 90 or greater than 90% payout, where you know a lot of casino games are like 50-60% sometimes, right? So yeah, I don't know. It's a really fascinating area of research, right? And I think the difficulty is getting hold of good data, like we did, getting hold of players as well, you know, getting them to agree to be contacted, agree to be interviewed, agree to do all of that stuff is very difficult. So we feel really privileged to actually have been given this opportunity. Like, it's a fascinating opportunity to have like all of this data, like all of this survey data, the ability to interview people, to kind of take their responses into account. It's just, it's a fascinating piece of work.
If people were forced to register for some kind of generic loyalty card,
uh-huh.
So say, could say more than a certain amount in a certain time,
yeah.
A very small amount, in, you know, sort of like over £10 an hour or something, do you think that would make it easier to identify problem gamblers?
Certainly, right? So I think it would make it easy, because everything is trackable, right? So you can say, okay, well, you know, how much did you really spend and things like that. But again, you know, what we're looking at is one small slice of the gaming market, right? So if for some reason people believe that, you know, that's causing them to lose more than usual or whatever it is, they shift quite easily to other forms of gambling. So what's really interesting is the sheer breadth of types of gambling, the sheer breadth of jurisdictions, the sheer breadth of, you know, various kinds of wages you can make, means like it's a bit of a balloon, right? You clamp down in one area and like it ends up in another area, right? So the so I think
but it would increase
the detection tool. Yeah, I mean, you're right about the jurisdiction. Yeah,
but you're right. I think it's one of those things where, like, you know, if you kind of look at the narrow problem that we all looked at, it's really fascinating. But if you step back and look at the really broad issues involved, it's, you know, it's a lifetime's work just to understand, like, you know, a few things. Like, where does addiction come from? Like, why are some people more prone to being addicted than others? Like, what is it? And the other thing as well that's really fascinating is that, you know, we are kind of labeling people in general as problem gamblers and non-problem gamblers, but if you actually look at their behavior, there are some sessions that are bang in line with the averages of people playing, and there are some sessions that are totally out of whack. Now, are we saying that problem gambling is a state of mind? Is it a state of time? Is it like, you know, this particular session comes from a this particular session is problematic, but the rest of it is not? But it could be that the rest of it led to this particular session, right? So it's a very complex, very, very complex thing. And so we spent a year doing this. And over the course of the year, we spent most of that year reducing the scope to something that was tractable, that could lead to scientific study. Because, you know, once you start going into counterfactuals and things like that, it just becomes really, really difficult to kind of draw any reliable conclusions, right?
Drawing back onto methodology a bit more,
yeah.
The gold standard that you use for your rock analysis was this Canadian questionnaire.
Yeah.
I wonder, one, were there any others available to you, any other similar questionnaires that you could use as your gold standard?
So, in many ways, there are, like, you know, there are tens of instruments that we could have used. So, and in fact, one of the things is, like, you know, simple two question things. Like, you know, have you ever lied about your betting, and have you ever done something else, right? So basically, it's called the lie bet test. Just simple two questions. Apparently, it gives you 80% or a large proportion of the predictive power of this. It's just that was the one that was the most backed up by academic research and the ones that seemed to be the most cited. So we used that.
The other thing is, how applicable do you think it is to true, if, well, if you separate true law of nature problem gambling, however we measure it, that way of getting a proxy by using a questionnaire, does a questionnaire where someone can answer, I usually have to borrow money or sell things in order to gamble and not get classified, it's an extreme example, and not get classified as a problem gambler, how big a disconnect do you feel there is between what we're able to measure as problem gambling with this instrument that you're now modelling the answer to?
I think there's a whole bunch of work you can do about, you know, kind of believability of the answers, right? So if you say, for example, so if we go back to the questionnaire, so for example, I think it's very hard to answer, well, some of the time or all of the time. Yeah, here we go. Is that the one?
I'd be very interested to see the psychometric properties.
Right, and so, again, like, so this is, the reason we use this is because it has been, you know, relatively well researched and relatively well documented. But it's difficult to answer truthfully always to one of them and never to all of the others. And besides, the other thing as well that's interesting is, you know, if it's, even if you answer one always or one almost always, you're in that moderate bracket, right? It's not like you're saying you have no problems, it's like you have fewer problems than something else. So if you truthfully answer, well, have I felt guilty, I always feel guilty about gambling, and then so for example, if you feel guilty, then surely it causes you stress or anxiety, right? So it's like, it's a reasonably well-constructed questionnaire where I guess, you know, what you could do certainly is like kind of tally up the responses and say, okay, look, you know, is this believable? Does this add up? Because
I'm surprised at the scale presented and scoring and the questions, that it behaves itself properly as a survey instrument.
Look, maybe you're right, but I think you also have to trade off the ability to administer it and get relatively truthful responses, right? So I think there is, so this one, you know, was felt to offer that right balance of, okay, well, I'll ask you a few simple questions. It doesn't take a huge amount of time to answer. It doesn't require hugely skilled or hugely trained people to administer it. And you know, you can actually go out and do 4,000 people in, you know, let's say a few weeks, rather than having like some clinical psychologist sit down and do that.
Is the order of the questions fixed?
I think it's the order. I think the order is fixed.
Because often, if it's done online, often the online surveys
you randomise.
In this case, I think the order of the questions could be quite critical.
So I don't have the paper. I should have probably, you know, that's my mistake for not putting it on. But I think it's something from 2001. And if you Google PGSI, it comes up. So again, you know, we were not the experts in this. NatSem did both they did the surveys, they did the sampling, and they gave us the results. So we did the data processing and the machine learning side of things, but that's what we did.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that occurred to me, for instance, for the question, have people criticised your betting, etc.
Yeah.
Supposing you have a young man who has a very stern mother.
Yeah.
You know, every time he goes out for the evening, he comes back in and she tells him off for about half an hour, even though he's only bet a pound.
Yeah.
Because he's 18.
Yeah.
It's almost always.
Maybe, right. But this is why you draw the cutoff around 6 or 7 or something like that. So it's like a single.
What was it? PGSI. Was
PGSI.
It?
Problem Gambling Severity Index. Yeah. And you probably get better hits if you just put the entire phrase in. Yeah.
What was the 2-question one? Live bet.
Yeah, the live bet test. Yeah, you should take a look at that.
Well, maybe that's it then. Thank you ever so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for standing up to all these questions.
Oh no, you're welcome. I think it's fascinating to get asked all of these questions. It's fascinating to present work, because I think when you're in the trenches, you kind of try and do what you can, but I think the ability to synthesize what we did and to present to a learned audience and, you know, get questions about methodology, you know, population behaviors that we were seeing, all of that kind of thing is, you know, really good practice. So I really enjoyed being here too. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you.
Anyone who wants to pay a stuff who hasn't already, with a little bit of the